This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm interviewing James McCommons, the author of a new book called Waiting on a Train, The Embattled Future of Passenger Rail Service. Hello, Jim.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing well today.
Good. Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk. This new book is actually coming out in November of 2009. And one of the other subtitles of the book is A Year Spent Riding Across America. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how you started this project, which is a pretty big undertaking. I think you spent a lot of time riding the rails, and maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I've been riding Amtrak since 1975 off and on, and every few years I would take a trip on Amtrak, sometimes more in one year than another, and sometimes 4 or 5 years would go by. But in 2007 I had a assignment for Audubon Magazine to go to Seattle, and I asked the editor, can I take a train instead of flying, and she said, sure. And it was a chance once again to get on a long-distance train, and got on the train, took my 13-year-old son with me, and we had a great trip, about half the trip from Chicago to Denver, and then to Sacramento, and then up to Seattle, went great, and then the other half went very badly. We got stuck behind freight trains. Amtrak had some equipment problems. Kind of all the things, all the travails of Amtrak happened that second half of that trip, to the point that we were 12 hours late coming into Sacramento. And I've had some great trips on Amtrak, and I've had some trips like that. And so, you know, I got off the train with the question is, after 30 years or so of Amtrak, why hasn't this experience gotten any better? And that gave me the germ of the idea that I would try to do a book, go out and ride the train over the course of a year for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, come home, do some more research, and just kind of figure out where is Amtrak, what is the future of passenger rail in this country, and how did we get the rail service we have today?
Well, and I think, you know, you do this very interestingly. I think the book is sort of part travelogue, where it's firsthand stories about what, you know, about your actual trips, and you mix that in with observations and history and stories about, you know, the politics and economics that are related to rail travel. I thought you did that really well, so that, excuse me, for the person that is not a, you know, knowledgeable about trains already, or who may not have a position, you know, an understanding of how rail really works in this country, you're not lecturing anybody. You're just, you know, you kind of allow people to enter the experience with you. So how many miles did you ride?
26,000 in all. And there were also a couple trips in there that I took that I didn't write about. I couldn't fit into the book.
And it seems like one of the things you liked about rail travel, of course, is the social, and you talk about this in the book, that you met a tremendous number of people.
I think that's always been the joy of me for rail travel. I'm not a rail fan or a rail buff, and I had a lot to learn to write this book to understand the history of railroading. But what I have done a lot is I've ridden the train because I enjoy the experience. I enjoy the geography, looking out the windows of the train. People often say, if you take a train, you see America from its backyard. And I think that's really true. And the other thing is that people on the train love to talk. And the experience of going down to the lounge car, the observation car, you have the time to have conversations, and you have a really interesting mix of people. So for me as a journalist, it was never that hard to talk to people and get them to open up. And because we were riding a train, the natural one of the natural conversation points was about rail travel.
Well, and you had lots of conversation. Now, one of the things that struck me, and I wanted to mention this because you said this early in the book, and I think this I have this right: 2% of the American population living today has ridden a train.
That's right. That's right. An inner city train. So, if you were talking about a commuter train or subway, more of us have ridden that, but, you know, very few of us have actually ridden an intercity train. And that's because train travel in this country isn't that convenient. Most towns do not have, you know, a connection to Amtrak. Amtrak comes through only once a day. Maybe it comes, if it does come through, it may come through late at night, or it may come every other day. So for a lot of us, train travel is not convenient, and I think that's one of the things this country has to change.
Well, and that's, I think that's one of the things I noticed and learned from the book, and this is the idea that sort of, you don't even realize it, but we are living in a fully declined train service system where, as you say, there are not enough trains to make rail travel a viable option for most people most of the time. And, you know, I hadn't really thought of that before, that, of course, when I was younger, there were rail options available. And while the trains were not working all that well prior to Amtrak, as they were declining then, still there were many more trains.
Sure.
And,
sure.
You know, I've thought about this for myself. When you look at travel options and then you discover, well, as you know, there's only one train and it comes at, you know, 9 o'clock at night and it gets in at 4 o'clock in the morning, that's not a really good choice.
That's right. I mean, a lot of people today, of course, are talking about high speed rail, and wouldn't it be great to have European style trains here? And I think it would, but one of the things that I learned by talking to passenger rail advocates around the country is, you don't necessarily need faster trains. You need trains with more frequent service. You need
right.
to make it convenient for people,
right?
And in fact, business travelers.
You also kind of highlight the cost of these bullet trains, and you know, of course, the distances are smaller in Europe and Japan, where the bullet trains are really effective. And maybe in this country, the answer is not bullet trains, but as you say, more frequent trains.
Well, I think that's going to be our incremental step to bullet trains. There are certainly places in this country where bullet trains are going to happen eventually and do make a lot of sense. Florida, Texas, California, and the Midwest. But what we're going to see before that is more frequent trains. We're going to see corridor service, that's service between two cities, perhaps less than 500 miles apart. But we'll be getting trains up to 110 miles per hour. And then eventually, I think, in the future, probably decades out, some of those lines will turn into, you know, full-blown 200-mile-an-hour trains.
Well, and the other thing I noticed in the book that I thought was really important was this notion of Amtrak has to make money in some way, or is looked at as losing money for the government,
right,
for the people of the United States, whereas the infrastructure of the airlines and of cars, of roads, are looked at as investments.
That's correct, and that was said to me by one of the sources that I interviewed in the train. That we sort of look at, we don't look at the money we put in Amtrak, which has been about $40 billion over the life of Amtrak, as an investment, that it's money thrown away. If Amtrak's done anything in this last 35 or 40 years, it's sort of been a placeholder. It's kept a skeletal rail system in place in this country that we can build upon. But that was one of the questions that I had, too, early on in the book, was should Amtrak make money? How did we come to this idea that it should, and will it ever? And the conclusion I came to, talking to a lot of people, including folks that helped create Amtrak, was that the whole idea of profitability was really not felt back then that it was going to work that way, and it hasn't, and it never will.
Right. No, I think the sense is that rail is a social good; it's a benefit for
right.
society, and therefore shouldn't have to make money. Whereas, you know, we look at the amount of money that's invested in roads. I guess I don't. Do you know how much, by comparison, has been invested in roads or air infrastructure during the same period as Amtrak has received $40 billion? How much have we spent on roads?
Well, hundreds of billions of dollars. And I think the figure that I can pull out of my head right now is that there is a proposed new transportation bill in Congress that would make a significant investment in rail. And that's about $500 billion over the next... the whole transportation bill is $500 billion over the next 5 to 6 years, about $330 billion would go towards roads, another 100 and some billion would go towards air, about $50 billion would go towards rail. So rail has never gotten that much money. So the vast majority of money has always gone to the air system and to the road system. But with Obama, with the stimulus plan, is talking about putting $8 to $12 billion into high-speed rail. But the real game changer is going to be this transportation bill, that it looks like the country is going to start investing in rail structure again. And so I think it's an incremental approach, but it's much more than we've done in the past.
Well, and it sounds like people are beginning to recognize that that rail has benefits that are worthwhile investing in. Corridors are already there. Even the ads that CSX runs, which I think are very effective,
yes,
saying that freight is both ecologically and economically better than roads, has some rub-off value for passenger trains.
Well, I think that we're at a period now where if we're looking towards really creating a greener economy, and if the prices of fuel, do go up again, if the price of energy, all those kinds of things do happen in the future, then rail is well positioned to grow again, whether it be both in freight or in passenger service. And I think there's also some recognition from some of these state Department of Transportations, and I went to a few of these places, in places like North Carolina, Illinois, Wisconsin, and California, where they recognize that rail has to be part of the transportation solution. So, you can't just keep building roads or enlarging roads. You have to have a parallel system of moving people as well.
Well, I thought there are a couple of other things that I thought were interesting. When you talk about the different states and which states have kind of embraced rail, which departments of transportation have gotten things going. I mean, you went to a lot of different states, state agencies, and you talk a lot about the different politics in each state. But how do you see the state role connecting to the federal role? How is that going to work?
Well, it'd be interesting to see what happens in a few weeks here with these stimulus funds, where they will go. But for instance, if they go to California, if California gets a good chunk of money, California will be sitting down with the freight railroads, negotiating an expansion of the infrastructure, and then the state will be bringing Amtrak in as a partner to basically run the trains. And in the book, I tried to go to states that are partnering with Amtrak, and in those states, it tends to be the state DOT that is actually interfacing with the freight railroads and also spending money on the infrastructure to increase the capacity of the infrastructure so they can run passenger trains. And only then do they bring in Amtrak as the operator. So in California and, for instance, in Oregon and Washington, Amtrak runs some very nice trains there. The state has paid for the infrastructure. The state has even purchased the trains that Amtrak's running because Amtrak doesn't have that much money. So it's going to be a partnership, just like the interstate highway system was. The feds will provide the bulk of the money, but the states are going to have to match the money, and the state DOTs will be deciding how that money will be used within their borders.
And the states that have already taken some steps,
yes,
to be ahead, they'll have advantages in terms of getting more federal money. Now, hopefully, when other states see that happening, that will create a little bit more energy in some of the places where there's been a lack of commitment, shall we say.
Absolutely. And, when I talked to some of these rail experts, that when Obama announced that they were going to have this $8 to $12 billion in stimulus money available, these rail experts were saying we need to channel it to these handful of states that are already working hard, already have relationships with the freight railroads and Amtrak, and we ought to be using those states as demonstration projects of what can happen.
Well, and I think that's what you need to do. It takes a long time, is convince those the other some 90% of Americans that don't even understand how rail fits in and what its purpose is, you know, they'll have to see the benefits because it is a political issue everywhere you go, asking people to spend their money.
It is. It is. And a lot of money is going to be spent on transportation. It always is. It's just a matter of how we're going to allocate those dollars.
Well, and there is one other thing, you know, speaking of the sort of advocacy of for rail, one thing that really struck me that you talked about in the book is that most passenger trains are running on rail lines that belong to freight companies, freight
That's
railroads.
Correct.
There only are a few left. They're heavily consolidated. They're large, multi-billion-dollar companies. But because Amtrak passenger trains run on somebody else's rails and freight has priority because that's where the freight companies are making the most of their money, in most cases, passenger trains take second position to any freight going by.
There's been this push-pull. There's been this almost adversarial relationship between Amtrak and the freight railroads. I mean, by law, freight railroads are supposed to give passenger trains priority. That was the agreement when Amtrak was created back in 1971. That hasn't always happened. Some railroads are better than others at moving their Amtrak trains down their infrastructure. So that has to be addressed. I mean, the freight railroads are these big multi-billion-dollar companies. They've been pretty profitable up until the recession here. And there's also been a lot of congestion on the infrastructure, which has been somewhat relieved by the recession. When I was riding the trains in 2007 and early 2008, before the recession, it was difficult sometimes for these passenger trains to move because there were so many trains out there on the tracks. And where we once had double tracks in this country, we've gotten down to single track. So the infrastructure in general needs, the capacity of the system needs to be improved and expanded. The freight railroads are doing that on their own, but there may be a role for the federal government and the state government to come in and partner with them to expand the infrastructure for both freight and for passenger trains.
Well, and it's so expensive to build railroad lines,
yeah,
more tracks. And it was sort of interesting. I guess I wanted to ask you about this, too. You know, the whole notion of tearing up tracks and abandoning lines, that seems to have gone on during our lifetimes without anybody really noticing it, because it was happening. You know, you might notice it if you lived in a place and you no longer had rail service of any kind. But why did the freight railroads tear up existing lines that they might have saved to use for the future?
Just simply because of cost. The railroad's a capital-intensive industry. If you're not going to use those tracks, they're going to deteriorate. And if you don't need them, you tend to, like any business, you consolidate. You don't put money into structures you're not going to use. And so in many instances, the railroads no longer needed two or three tracks to move their trains. So they took out two tracks. They sold some of the rail for scrap. They moved it to different places. In the railroad industry, when Amtrak was created around 1970s, really was almost in many ways passing from the scene. The passenger service certainly was. It wasn't being used. We were all driving our big cars down these brand new interstates, and the railroads were on life support. I make a comparison that in the book. Just as we talk now about General Motors and about the government having to step in to save some of these big, like the auto industry, that was the same thing was true of the railroad industry back then. There was a huge loss of business for the railroads, whether it be both people and freight, and they really remained in business by hauling things that trucks could not haul, coal, gravel, those kinds of things, iron ore. So there wasn't a need for a lot of this infrastructure. So we did things like abandon them. We turned rails into trails, those kind of things. At the same time, this infrastructure is still out there. It still does go out to all areas of the country. Even the rails, the trails, those areas are in what they call a banking system that someday they could be reactivated to be a railroad again. And there's also room on these right-of-ways where there is now single track that we could be adding two and three tracks. So there is a good possibility of being able to ramp up the infrastructure and the industry. Now, that's going to take money, but the right-of-ways are there. And that really is probably the most important thing, because assembling these corridors from scratch right now, which California is going to try to do with their bullet train, that's on the books there, that's very expensive.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. I actually, you know, there's so many other things to talk about, including some of the stories that you told, but I guess we've run out of time. I do want to thank you, and I recommend this book to anybody who's interested in transportation policy, or even if you're just a rail fan and you love trains and you love the history of trains and think about stories that relate to trains. There's a very rich story in this book. Waiting on a Train, The Embattled Future of Passenger Rail Service by James McCommons. And I want to thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Take care.